Hello and welcome to day 9 of the Eurocopa podcast, sponsored by Sling Latino. I'm your host, Nipun Chopra. Thanks for joining us. In order to review today's two games, as well as preview Tuesday's games, I am joined by Kristen Hennaj, Karthik Krishnayer, and Sam Kelly. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me. Let's start with the reviews, guys. Panama versus Bolivia. Karthik, I think we should start with a stat. I know we kind of get stat obsessed, but I think this gives us an idea of what was going on in this game. 35 fouls in the game at the 75th minute, and a lot more after that. So pretty feisty game.
Yeah, very feisty game. Really compelling game. Unfortunately, I didn't make it to the game. I was slated to cover this game. I got caught in the storm, which I think everybody saw who watched around the world on television, was present in Orlando today during and in the state of Florida during the match. So I actually ended up having to cancel my ticket formally about 15 minutes before game time because I wasn't able to make it to the Citrus Bowl. But that weather led to a very kind of chippy affair. Mm-hmm. It was cooler than it normally would be in the summer, cooler than I think any Copa game in this tournament to this point maybe will be for the entire tournament. Temperatures were in the 70s Fahrenheit. It had rained all day, intense rain. You have a temporary pitch sitting over the turf at the Citrus Bowl, so that temporary grass pitch was holding up very well, but it created a chippy atmosphere, an urgency to score goals early because we weren't sure when the next delay would come. The teams weren't able to practice on the pitch, do the sorts of things you normally do, the kind of walk through before a match. And there was a lot of pent-up aggression. The players hadn't really gotten out before the match. So that was one of the factors. And then I think another important thing to note in this match is knowing Chile and Argentina are the other two teams in this group. Both Panama, and I mentioned many times on the show, Panama has a very good record on U.S. soil, the best record of any CONCACAF nation outside the U.S. and Mexico. Even though Costa Rica and Honduras qualify for tournaments for the World Cup more regularly, Panama's never qualified for a World Cup. Panama actually has a better record in competitive matches on U.S. soil than any than Costa Rica or Honduras. So they come into this with a little bit of confidence, and they have several players who have either played in Major League Soccer in the past or are playing in Major League Soccer now. So they wanted to get after it, and we saw Quintero, who plays for San Jose, and Blas Perez really get after after Bolivia in this game. But I think it was a chippy affair because there was a lot of the weather, a lot of pent up playing today. They didn't get out and practice, and also because there was a fear that there would be a delay, a lightning delay, or another weather-related delay in the middle of this match, and the players want to get out and score goals early before that delay comes, because once there's a delay, the total dynamics of a match change. And in international tournaments, we tend to not want to see these. We see it at the club level all the time, right, where their mm-hmm. games get broken up. There's a rain delay, 90 minutes, or lightning delay. But at the international level, very rarely do governing bodies want to see that happen. So they went ahead and played through, but there was that fear before the game. So both teams were very aggressive.
Chris, talk to me about Blas Perez. Given my admitted European bias, a player that I haven't really watched too much, he's very well traveled, has played all over the place, including in Mexico at Pachuca, recently at FC Dallas, and that's why I wanted to talk to you. So what did you see during his time at MLS that sold you on the striker? Because you actually talked about him a fair amount in the preview.
Yeah, I think what you can say about Blas Perez, one of the reasons I think FC Dallas let him go in the first place was he just wasn't mobile enough for them and what they needed, because their attack is, it's all about pace, it's all about energy, it's all about movement. And look, he's well into his 30s. I think he'll be the first to admit he's not that mobile forward. Now, Vancouver found a home for him because I think they accepted they needed someone with his sort of poaching ability, his predatory instinct. And we saw that really come to the fore today for Panama. And I think that's what you have to say about them as a national team, is they appreciate what he brings to the table and use that in a constructive way for their needs. I don't think it's a slight to say that he had to leave FC Dallas. I think it's just a bad fit at that point. Mm-hmm. The thing I think you have to contrast any credit you give to Panama is really, as we touched on in the preview, Bolivia will be whipping boys. I can't see them doing any great shakes with this tournament personally. The fact that they lose Moreno due to a dispute with the head coach and him excuse me, him some not so much retiring as kind of rejecting invitations to come, similar to Giovanni Dos Santos. When you lose a player of his caliber, and he is arguably one of the highest caliber players you've got, I think that speaks volumes to the position you're likely to find yourself in, with all due respect to them. I just think, again, you'll struggle to see Bolivia do anything of note in this tournament. And you contrast that with the fact that, again, Panama looks solid, but I can't see them making huge dents in it. I think they'll have moments, but I'm not sure if those moments will align enough to do anything significant.
Let me just jump in for one more point on Blas Perez. He was actually a designated player with Dallas. His contract expired, traded to Vancouver. Now he's under the maximum MLS salary. So part of his move was a salary dump. And those are the kind of nuances that only happen in MLS because of all these strange rules, myriad of rules. But I agree with Chris. I think it was more of a fit thing, and he's now a pretty good fit in Vancouver, actually.
Yeah. So before I move to Sam, I have to point out the fact that Chris was watching The Bachelor today or Bachelorette, and I will never podcast with you again because of it, Chris. Let's talk, Sam, about the fact that in multiple points in this game, I thought that Panama was able to open up Bolivia with a simple pass behind the fullback. And as Chris mentioned, the whipping boy thing, that's the sort of schoolboy defending that's one of the first things you learn, even playing college ball, is that that's one of the most vulnerable areas on the inside of the fullback. So very schoolboy defending from Bolivia in that sense.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Bolivia have certain advantages, I guess you could say, with regard to their conditioning. Obviously, most of them have essentially spent their entire lives doing high altitude training.
Right.
But you can't really get very far beyond once they come down below high altitude venues, like obviously their home ground of La Paz, but also one or two of the other stadia that they play away games in the South American qualifiers, such as when they play Ecuador in Quito, for instance. If they come down below that altitude, if they come down anywhere near sea level, they're hamstrung by just not being very good at football. I feel awful saying it. I'd love them to get back up to the point that they were at, the last time they were playing in a tournament on US soil in 94. But it doesn't look like it's going to happen anytime soon. They have been among the whipping boys in the South American World Cup qualifying campaign for some time. They're more than capable in La Paz, historic giants of South American football like Argentina and Brazil and Uruguay. Any one of those three teams, when they play an away World Cup qualifier in La Paz, look on a draw as being a good result. But when it comes to the reverse fixtures, Bolivia frequently fail to impress. I mean, they often manage to, lose by relatively narrow margins by just packing everybody behind the ball, particularly against Argentina in recent years. I think they lost 1-0 or 2-1 fairly recently in Buenos Aires in the most recent or the last but one load of qualifiers. But yeah, I mean, essentially they're not a very good football team.
Yeah, Karthik, the amazing thing is that we've said all this, but at the same time, had Ramayo put away that header right from the start, from the kickoff after the second goal, the game would have ended as a tie. So very narrow margins, even though we've been giving Panama so much credit.
Yeah, that's true. Very narrow margins. But again, I think there's a little bit of sentiment for Panama in this tournament among
Sure.
fans in the United States, because there's this feeling that there was a great robbery last year on American soil with Mark Geiger, the official in that Gold Cup semifinal game against Mexico. So I sensed that before this weather snafu prevented me from actually getting to the stadium in Orlando. But talking to people who were getting excited about this game, going to this game, neutral fans, American There seems to be there might be, you might see this in the games against Argentina and Chile, two big teams, that there are Americans that are rooting for Panama, neutrals who are buying tickets, who are following this tournament, because one, they're a CONCACAF country, and two, because they feel like there was a great injustice last year. And I sensed that today in Orlando also, that they had the crowd behind them, and they probably will as long as they're alive in this tournament.
Yeah. So, gentlemen, before we switch to talking about the game of the day, Argentina-Chile, let me tell you a little bit about our sponsor, SeatGeek. So one of my friends, who will remain nameless at this point, asked me if I knew of tickets for where she could get tickets for tomorrow's game, the U.S. men's national team game in Chicago. And I said, well, that's funny you ask, because you should check out SeatGeek. And she did, and she actually found that she was pretty excited by the fact that when she bought the tickets, there weren't the usual fees associated with those tickets that other avenues of purchasing tickets charge you. So she was pretty excited about that. So what I love about SeatGeek and what she did was that they're always honest and upfront about the price, and they show you the full ticket price from start to finish and never try to trick you with huge fees on that checkout page, which is something that we've all become accustomed to and almost expect at this point. So the thing is, this is how you can get those tickets. And I think you should check it out, because it's worth your time, especially if you're looking for tickets for the Copa or upcoming International Champions Cup, which will kick off in a few weeks, in a month or so, actually. And this is what you have to do. You're actually going to get a $20 rebate for your first SeatGeek purchase, which is awesome. And this is how you get it. So step one, you download the free SeatGeek app. Step two, you go to the settings tab and click add a promo code. Step three, enter promo code WSTPOD. And step four, SeatGeek will send you $20 after you've made your first ticket purchase. So go ahead and download that free SeatGeek app and enter promo code WSTPOD today and buy some tickets and make sure you get to watch the incredible soccer that's on view. As we've been calling it, it is the summer of soccer, and we should all be watching some wherever we are in this in the United States. So, gentlemen, let's get back to talking about soccer now. And the very exciting game between Argentina and Chile today. Chris, let me start with this. What I noticed from I'm sure we're going to wax lyrical in some ways about Argentina, and you know, Sam will help us do that. But what I noticed today a lot were a couple of things. They were very good with the ball on the ground, as we would expect with Argentina, especially with the overlapping fullbacks. Every time they played the ball into the middle on the ground, those balls almost always connected. Every time they actually tried to cross the ball, on the other hand, they almost never connected, and in some cases actually went to the other side of the field. So talk to me about that. This is something that has become more apparent in the game as we've gone along. Fullbacks tend to send flatter crosses, and the old school whipping cross, the bending cross, has become more and more rare from fullbacks.
Yeah, I think that's a very interesting point. It's curious, if you look at the emergence of Cameron Borthwick-Jackson at Man United, how many people have touched on the fact that he can put in an exceptional cross, and how sort of rare that seems. I think, again, the game moves in spheres and goes through phases, much like fashion. And I simply think it's been a case of it's not been a skill that's been taught as consistently. And, you know, I don't think we're the only ones to notice it, or you're the only one to notice it by any stretch. It's something that strikes me most weekends watching the Premier League and MLS, is that consistently, not even just fullbacks, wingers, players in general, they can't seem to put a cross in the same way they could 10, 15 years ago. Mm-hmm. And I think what you have to think or try and gauge from it is perhaps it's the emergence really of a much shorter game in terms of passing distance, but then also the way that the ball moves. It tends to move through central areas now. It doesn't go down the sides as much as it used to. And if you look at the most prevalent formation, for the most part, it's usually a front three. And in that, you don't really have traditional wingers. You tend to have an inside forward or an advanced playmaker or someone who really isn't fitting in the mold of, let's say, David Beckham being perhaps the archetypal winger of years gone by. You don't have that player, I think, as consistently in teams now, and there's not really seen as a need for them, and consequently you will see things die off like that. It's a sort of supply and demand, I guess, is the best way to put it.
Yeah. Sam, a player that can actually send those incredible whipped crosses is the player we'll talk about next. And he can pretty much do anything he wants on the pitch when he's on form, and that's Di Maria. Definitely the man of the match today, a goal and an assist, and involved in pretty much every attacking move that Argentina produced. But as Juan Arango pointed out yesterday, has kind of been missing a little bit for Argentina since the World Cup. So as someone who watches Argentina very closely, living in Argentina, talk to me about the perception of Di Maria and what you think he brought to the game today.
The perception is very much divided, I think it's fair to say. There are people who absolutely love him, and to look at the record that he has for the national team, which in terms of sort of brute statistics, if you like, is pretty impressive. And there are people who are not such fans of the slightly, shall we say, headless chicken sort of manner in which he plays at times. And I'm kind of somewhere between the two schools of thought. I think that Di Maria is one of the best players in the world and has been yep. for some time. When he's part of a system that is set up to counterattack, to run into space behind an opposing team who are leaving space in that final third to take advantage, and when teammates are able to give him the ball and point up the pitch and go, right, Angel, run that way really fast and then kick it to a teammate or kick it towards the goal. He's fantastic at doing that. Once a slightly more thoughtful game's required, once Argentina get into a situation where they're dominating possession against teams, for instance, and Di Maria's getting on the ball and he's not got that space to think because the opponents are already sitting back, he's not got that space to run into because the opponents are sitting back and he has to think a little bit more. He can come more in and out of the game and he can be much flakier. I think that today was a fine example of the former situation because, of course, Chile went for it. They're an attacking team. It has to be said, who have not been as well managed by Juan Antonio Pizzi as they were under Jorge Sampaoli, who, of course, left shortly after winning the Copa America with them last year. But they're a team who like to go forward and who are going to leave those spaces for players like Di Maria to exploit. Whether he's going to be quite as... I mean, I'm not saying he's necessarily... I'm not going to predict an outright poor game. He might very well score, given the positions that he's taking up. But whether he's going to be quite as effective and quite as completely central to everything that Argentina do that's good against Panama and Bolivia, we will have to wait and see. And I would almost be tempted to say the same thing about Argentina's performance as a team more generally. This kind of game that we saw today, a very open game where they've got spaces to run into and chances to attack the opposing box, is one that very much suits them because of the enormous wealth of attacking talent that they've got. When they start to get the situation where to force things a little bit more, that's where they sometimes find it a little bit harder.
Yeah, that's interesting because if you had told me that the reason Di Maria struggled at United was because of the possession-based system, I would have definitely agreed with you.
Yeah, precisely. I mean, that's what I thought at the time. I'm a United fan. And when Good we man. Signed Di Maria, I thought it was a very peculiar signing, given that the club had just announced Louis van Gaal as manager. Mm-hmm. Given that everybody knows how Louis van Gaal likes to play, Louis van Gaal was making a big show of how he wanted to play, and he wanted players who were clever, players who were going to not act on instinct, but who were going to be thinking about what they were doing. Every ball was going to be calculated. Mm-hmm. And then they go out and spend a British record fee on Angel Di Maria. And I remember thinking even at the time, like, really? Him?
Right.
To fill that role? This doesn't entirely seem like... I mean, apparently you have Van Gaal's blessing, but it wasn't particularly surprising when it didn't work out, and that's not because I don't think Di Maria is a good player. He was poorly suited to that system.
Yeah, well said. Karthik, it's an interesting thing with Di Maria with Argentina. I mean, I could talk about Di Maria with United for days, but let's talk about Di Maria with Argentina. Because for me, with my watching of the Argentina team in the last 3 or 4 years, maybe this is a bit of a bias because I think he is one of the best players in the world. I think Argentina play best when Di Maria is playing best. And I think Argentina struggle when Di Maria struggled or injured. I think he plays well in the big games. And I think when he goes missing, for example, the final against Germany when he was injured, I think Argentina struggle. And I think that was true today too. When Di Maria plays well, Argentina plays well. Is he that important, or am I over-exaggerating here?
No, I think he's that important. In fact, I've made that case during CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying in 2013 and 2012 that I thought, and with our colleague Juan Arango, he and I are on a podcast somewhere, and probably on the same stream, talking about that very issue and how important Di Maria, how critical he was to Argentina in qualifying, how he was, and he was a guy very few people were talking about. Sam may have a different perspective on this because maybe in Buenos Aires they were talking about him, but in Western Europe and here in the United States,
it's all about Messi. It's all about Messi,
right? Yeah. Well, yeah. and Higuain and Aguero and Javier Mascherano, Tevez still at the time, but although Tevez was actually kind of out of the national team already by that point,
had fallen out with Messi at that point,
right? Yeah, but. Di Maria is further down the pecking order. I would take this a step further and say at Real Madrid in the 13-14 season, where, of course, they got La Decima, right? They got their 10th Champions League, European Cup / Champions League trophy, that he was the most influential players in the games they had to win in Europe.
I mean, Ancelotti said that.
Influential than Ronaldo
was. Yes, yeah, Ancelotti said that himself. He said that he was, that Di Maria was a central part of that, switching him in that central outside central left midfield position when he played that 4-3-3 was the defining factor in why they won the La Decima. So yeah, I completely agree with you there.
And in the two leg tie against Bayern, where they just skinned them on the counter, right? Wasn't it against Bayern?
Yeah, I think. And
Di Maria was so critical to that. We remember Ronaldo scoring goals, but it was all of those counterattacking moves began on the left side of midfield with Di Maria playing there, which just goes back to the point Sam made. I know maybe we're getting a little far afield from Argentina here, but he's that kind of player. Does he's going to play a possession-based system? It was an odd signing from the get-go, wasn't it?
Yeah. Chris, let's talk about Chile a little bit here. So the thing I noticed most about Chile, especially in the first half, Chris, first of all, shame on you for not laughing at my bachelorette joke. That was a no sell, and I don't appreciate it. So you'll continue to no sell, won't you, Chris? Okay, so let's talk about Chile. So I felt that in the first half, Chile was trying to get the ball to Alexis Sanchez. And actually, Alexis Sanchez had the beating of Otamendi a couple of times, turned him the wrong way a couple of times, but then had really no one to distribute the ball to and ended up trying to shoot on goal a couple of times where he might not have done in other situations. So I don't know if this was a success of Argentina to isolate Alexis Sanchez, or maybe failure on the part of Chile to not support him enough.
I think that's a brilliant question. It was something that I talked about in the previews, the notion of Alexis Sanchez being talismanic for Chile, and actually that being a bit of a problem, at least in the attack, if not kind of universally. And it was something actually I got a lot of criticism for. Mm-hmm. And I think the issue I have with Alexis sometimes, and it does pertain to this game, is he will carry the ball very well, but he will almost carry it for too long. Now, I think in fairness, some of the issue with the situation is he's not blessed with great movement around him. So he'll pick up the ball and in an almost unintentional way, the players will freeze as a consequence. His teammates will freeze. And I noticed this a few times, particularly in the second half. He would pick up the ball and he would either go past Otamendi or he would go past Mascherano or one of the midfielders. And you would be looking for someone, be it Vargas or whomever, to make that kind of cutting run, be it in behind the fullback or something like that. And it just wasn't ever there. And even when he kind of got it in the box, there wasn't really enough space at that point. If he's coming deep like that, which, again, I'm not sure how natural that really is for him. He does it sometimes for Arsenal, but it tends to be when they're struggling. You need someone to be making some intelligent movement off the back of that to either open up space for him or to open up space and facilitate a pass. And that is what was lacking for me with Chile tonight, on top of, I think, just non-existent defensive midfielders.
Yeah. Sam, I'm glad we have you on, because I wanted to ask you this question. So on paper, this Argentina team is a team right out of Football Manager, a team that, you know, if I were building a team, I would sign a lot of these players. Perfect example of that is the fact that Sergio Aguero, one of the best strikers in the world, didn't start today. Some of it might be fitness related, but, you know, any other team in the world would have started a half-fit Sergio Aguero. That's how good he is. So a Messi injury notwithstanding, what do you see are the hurdles that would prevent this Argentina team from winning the Copa?
Well, two things that prevented Argentina from winning the World Cup 2 years ago, I was going to say, yeah. And which you touched on in a way in asking the question, were injury worries. We've already mentioned Di Maria's mm-hmm. injury during that World Cup. And also, funnily enough, Argentina did play a half-fit Sergio Aguero towards the beginning of that
good
campaign,
point.
And it came back to bite them on the arse because he broke down, which is something that he's been developing something of a habit.
And wasn't Messi also carrying an injury towards the later stages of the World Cup as well?
He looked like he wasn't quite fully fit. If I remember rightly, Messi had a few weeks out shortly before the end of the season, had come back for the end of the season for Barcelona and seemed to be tiring a little bit. Higuain, for the World Cup campaign, didn't train until shortly before the very opening match because of an injury that he was carrying from the end of his domestic season as well. So fitness is one thing, particularly given the injury record of not so much of Messi, because I mean he's not really had any serious injuries for most of his career, and more than anything they're trying to take care of him now and make sure that he only plays once he's fully fit in this tournament. So not so much for him, but for the attackers around him, fitness could be a bit of an issue, particularly with Di Maria and Aguero. And after that, it's the psychology of it. I mean, there are lots and lots of people down here, continent from what I'm seeing on Twitter, but certainly in Buenos Aires, who aren't looking on this as a proper, let's say, canonical Copa America, which, in my opinion, is fair enough. It's a celebration of the Copa America rather than a Copa America in and of itself, as it were. But undeniably, it's a chance psychologically for Argentina to end their trophy drought. I mean, if they win this competition, then the players will be able to say that they have lifted the first major trophy since the last Copa America they won, which was 1993, which is, you know, a longer time than a country the size of Argentina in footballing terms expects to go. So the two main obstacles that spring to mind are fitness, because you never know what's going to happen. One bad tackle for the wrong player could seriously affect their chances, and the psychology, whether they become their own worst enemies. I think that in psychological terms, I do think that the World Cup final appearance in Brazil is going to have helped them enormously. It seemed to, once they managed to get over that quarterfinal hurdle, they seemed like a very, very strong team indeed to me then. That was the first time they've gone beyond the quarterfinals since the 1990 losing appearance in the World Cup final. But obviously the very last hurdle now, with two finals in as many years in the last two competitions, is getting very frustrating for them. So the psychology is going to be the almost the main thing, I think.
Yeah. Karthik, one more possibility there is the goalkeeper, right? Sergio Romero started the season for Man United when David De Gea had his transfer situation with Real Madrid. Last game he played in the league was end of August, where we lost 2-1 to Swansea City. He actually was culpable for one of those goals. De Gea comes back. United beats Liverpool the following 2 weekends later, and then De Gea stays in the team. Since then, Romero's played one game when I think it was an FA Cup or a Carling Cup game, and essentially has come into this tournament as has started this game, and he was culpable for the goal that Argentina gave up. So that's an area of concern for Argentina.
Correct. It was an area of concern, I think, coming into the tournament, and he came off his line, didn't get that claim that ball on the free kick, and he had no business coming off his line. That having been said, I of course have consistently throughout the European club season fingered Bravo as one of the three best goalkeepers in the world.
Mm-hmm. And he was culpable.
Which goalkeeper do you think was actually more culpable today?
Good point.
So, I mean, you can't always base it on club form coming into international tournaments. Higuain is the most lethal striker on the European continent, who's not playing for a team which scores a boatload of goals like Barcelona and Real Madrid do. That's why I almost put asterisks next to their guys and say I think Higuain had the strongest season of an out-and-out striker in Europe, because you qualifiers next to Ronaldo and Messi and Suarez and Lewandowski. And today, he was missing that level of sharpness, it seemed. That kind of cutting edge when he was playing. So sometimes club form doesn't translate. And so I would be concerned that Romero has played so little. That having been said, he's still training with Manchester United. He was still dressing for every game. It's a different thing if you're not mentally prepared to play, which is what happens with third keepers, right? Because they don't dress, they never play, and they don't go through the reps for a game. Romero, once Victor Valdez was run off, Romero, it was clear Louis van Gaal had him as the number two or the number one until the De Gea thing was sorted. So he had gone through the routine of dressing and prepping and being on the bench for all these games. So I think that was that's pretty critical when you look at his match prep. Is he going to be completely sharp? No, but he's not necessarily the best keeper either. We didn't expect we tend to expect that kind of mistake out of him. Whereas with Bravo today, I was surprised in his reaction and misreading the game in front of him, quite frankly.
Sam, you had something to say about Romero.
Yeah, the only other thing I wanted to add to what Karthik's just said is that this isn't a new feeling for Sergio Romero either. I mean, he's essentially his entire club career
has been a backup. You're right. Yeah.
Pretty much, he's been backup exactly, with the exception of, remember rightly, a couple of seasons at AZ Alkmaar when he first moved to Europe under Louis van Gaal, funnily enough, and then one season for Sampdoria when they were in Serie B. With those exceptions, he's been a backup wherever he's gone. I did, after United signed him last summer on a free transfer, I did a sort of profile for him of him on ESPN and looked into the numbers. And I think at that point, he'd something like one quarter of all of his first team appearances in his entire career were for Argentina. Because he actually holds the Argentina record. He is Argentina's most capped goalkeeper ever. In spite of being a backup, he's never seriously let down his country. Obviously, you know, every goalkeeper is going to be guilty of an error from time to time, and he was to blame for Chile's goal today. There are one or two others. I mean, I can remember a World Cup qualifier for the 2014 World Cup away to Paraguay, in which he made an absolute howler at one point, and I think he was to blame for the other goal as well. Paraguay scored two, Argentina scored five. He's never made a howler in a match that I've seen, which has actually cost Argentina. Mm-hmm. And of course, in a number of matches, he's essentially a national hero here, thanks to the 2014 World Cup, especially the semi-final, his performance in the penalty shootout that got them into the final. So he's a very weird kind of goalkeeper to pin down, because on the one hand, you're completely correct that it's totally illogical. If you're the manager of one of the biggest national football teams in the world, the current top-ranked side by FIFA on the planet, to be playing a guy in goal who doesn't get any games. And yet somehow it seems to work out all right for him. And his mental fortitude is absolutely part of that as well. And also Alejandro Sabella used to make the point when he was managing Argentina that Romero is a very, very strong part of the group. Lionel Messi gets on very, very well with him. He gets on very, very well with all of the other players as well. And Sabella prized that, and obviously Martino prizes that as well, because if you have a group of people who are very together in a tournament atmosphere, that's arguably as important as having a good goalkeeper.
Yeah, good point. Chris, let's get into previews. Let's preview the Colombia-Paraguay game really quickly so we can talk about the USA-Costa Rica game. Chris, let's start with the fact that, first of all, well, let's contextualize this, because Rodriguez's status is still unknown. Probably Moreno would probably start in front of him, but at the end of the day, it's really going to be Juan Cuadrado who's going to be the out ball. So that will be the area that Paraguay would be looking to nullify.
They will. You're right, because he has, I think, seniority, he has pedigree to his name. I think in many ways, Malos Moreno is someone I kind of tipped to be a potential breakout for this tournament, because I think he has a lot of the right attributes to succeed. And reading kind of background stuff on him, the general consensus in Colombia is that he will leave soon and he will likely head to Liverpool of all places. I think this is a good opportunity for him to show that he can handle that step up, because, I mean, as you said there in the question, he won't be expected to perform, but he will be expected to contribute something, I think. And I think that's the right level of pressure for a man his age. In terms of Paraguay, on the contrast of that, I'll be very surprised if they don't start Sanabria. He's a very talented forward. He's someone who I've talked with to David Cartledge, who, as well as being a Gijón fan, is a wonderfully talented Spanish football journalist. And he does really kind of rave about him. And he's not someone to blow wind up someone who's not worth it. So I'll be very surprised if they don't go for him. I mean, he took the place of Rocky Santa Cruz in the squad, which is fitting when you consider he made his debut by replacing Santa Cruz in a friendly against Germany. I think the time is now to unleash him, so to speak. Because watching the Costa Rica game, as wonderful as Costa Rica were in defence, I didn't really feel as if Paraguay were ever likely to score, personally. So hopefully we'll see some goals in that game at least, because I think a nice early one will set the tone and give us an entertaining game, if nothing else.
Sam, for Paraguay, Jorge Benitez will have to be more clinical than he was in that draw against Costa Rica in order for them to get anything out of this game.
Yeah, he will. As will, in fact, Paraguay's other players, because it wasn't a particularly... what's the word I'm looking for? It wasn't a particularly dignified match for going forward on either team. I think that it's going to be a very, very tight game again from Paraguay's point of view. But also, of course, I guess one of the interesting things about both of these matches coming up in Group A is that the openers were both in this group, CONCACAF against CONMEBOL. And now we've got one all CONCACAF tie and one all CONMEBOL tie, which means that both matches are going to be between teams who know each other a lot better than the teams that they've
That's
just played.
A good point, yeah.
And so although obviously Colombia have got the more obvious star quality, although Paraguay have got some talent as well, Colombia have perhaps got the biggest star draw and the more obvious attacking quality. But Paraguay know how to break him down. I think I'm right in saying, sang Ramon Diaz's praises as the Paraguay manager on my previous appearance on this podcast. He's a very canny boss. And as a result, I don't think that it's... I mean, I think that Colombia are going to be favourites, probably, but not by a landslide, let's say. Paraguay can dig in and make it very awkward for them.
Yeah. Karthik, let's talk about USA-Costa Rica now. It's a must-win game for the U.S. men's national team. We've spent at least a little bit of time on every single podcast really talking about the U.S. men's national team. And let's start where we left off the conversation yesterday with Juan, and where we were talking about tactical shifts with Juan and Robert. And do you expect Nagbe to start tomorrow? Do you expect them to go to a 4-4-2? What are you hoping?
What am I hoping for? Or what am I expecting? Because I'm expecting Klinsmann to be stubborn, having publicly declared that only two moments in the match separated the United States and Colombia, and somehow this was an even match, maybe tilted toward the U.S. If you take those two moments out, and the 4-3-3 that he set up the team very awkwardly and worked. Again, I don't think U.S. manager and Jeff Cameron, the player who came out and made similar comments, were watching the same game as the rest of us. I think Colombia was very comfortable in this match, as we've talked about repeatedly on this show. Yeah. However, if that's their narrative, and Klinsmann is a narrative-based manager. He's not a manager who's based on getting results. He's not a manager who's based on setting up his team in a proactive way to either take the game to the opposition or to sit back and absorb pressure and hit teams on the counter, which is what the U.S. did at times during the Bob Bradley era. He's a manager that bases a lot of his player selection and team selection on, for lack of a better word, passing the buck. So continuing with the 4-3-3 fits his narrative. He's trying to play attractive, open football in this tournament that the United States is hosting. And unfortunately, one thing or another will lead to a couple individual errors, or that the players aren't fit enough, or the domestic league isn't producing good enough players for him. There'll be some laundry list of excuses, so some litany of excuses for him, because he's great at that. And he's great at getting at least half the media in this country who covers the sport to buy into it. I think there's some of us who are very skeptical. I know Chris has covered the national team very closely and has been skeptical and has asked kind of questions that some of my colleagues don't ask. But I expect him to set up in that 4-3-3 again. I think you're probably going to see the same first 11. Now, if I were looking to make a change, I would kind of admit that even though he played very well for Big Sam at the end of the season, and that was after a season of Big Sam, or he took over from Dick Advocaat in October, a while of Sam trying to use other players, Billy Jones at right back, signing Aboué, and then there was a ban on Aboué because of agent payments, your ban, so he couldn't play right back, that DeAndre Yedlin finally learn how to play defensively in a way Sam Allardyce would want you to. However, that's still a small sample size of games. We saw the DeAndre Yedlin again on Friday, which you don't like to see at right back. So I think if there's one change maybe Klinsmann makes, he might move Fabian Johnson to right back, play Matt Beisler at left back. But otherwise, I don't think he's going to make a change. I don't think he's going to start Nagbe. I don't think he's going to start.
What about Castillo at left back? That's something I've been
reading about. He could play Castillo at left back. But I don't think he's going to play Pulisic and Nagbe from the start, even though that's what everybody wants to see. Because here's another thing about Klinsmann and narratives. Klinsmann never wants to admit that the peanut gallery of U.S. men's national team fans, the critics, that is, and the media that are skeptical and say certain players should start. Guys like Leander Scherlakens, who's been a very strong critic of Klinsmann, he never wants to give in to those journalists or those high-profile fans' demands. So he might hold this against Nagbe and Pulisic. And there are very few managers in international football at major football playing nations that are this stubborn about things like that. So I wouldn't expect to see those guys start.
Chris, talk to me about that 4-3-3. I can't help but wonder if, in spite of his limitations, Beckerman might be able to bring out the best of Bradley, because what we saw in Colombia is as soon as you shut down Bradley, it's easy to nullify this U.S. men's national team game. And if Bradley is stuck in those deeper positions, now you're in a situation where the ball is being turned over in deeper positions. So having Beckerman as the traditional water carrier might allow Bradley to be in a slightly more advanced position and pull the strings.
I feel what you need to try and do with the United States midfield three is realistically you need to look at Portland as the blueprint and say that Nagbe, coincidentally, fits the Nagbe role. Bradley plays the role of Valeri, and then you essentially need a Diego Chara of sorts.
Yeah.
who that player is, it's so difficult to say. I personally, it's not Kyle Beckerman. Let me put that out there to begin with.
It
I
might be
personally
Jermaine
think
Jones,
Kyle
actually.
Beckerman is someone that possibly. I think the concern I have with Jermaine Jones is he looked all of his age the other day against Colombia. I just think again, Chara has legs. Definitely, there's a lot more to his game than just legs, though, and I think that's the blueprint you need to be looking at instead of saying let's put Kyle Beckerman in there, who's a very limited player, I think, in what he gives you just to facilitate Bradley moving further forward. I think that is slightly one of the issues the US has at the minute. It's a little bit too talismanic with Bradley. It's all about making him work, otherwise the team doesn't work. And it's a similar thing with Dempsey in the attack. You've got to play Dempsey, you've got to get him involved, or the attack is useless. Actually, by putting him in a central position and feeding into him so much, you really did kind of negate the influence of Bobby Wood and Jassy Zardes, because you shunted them out wide when realistically, Wood in particular is never going to be of great use when he's out wide. He needs to be central. He needs to be able to run that main channel through the middle so he can cause some damage with his pace. I just think the changes that are actually needed by Jürgen Klinsmann are not changes he's likely to make. It's a shame that someone like Kellyn Acosta missed out on the squad, or even Danny Williams. I think I'd have been very curious to see either of them come in and potentially offer something in there, if that's actually a possibility.
Yeah, and Chris, to follow up on that point, I think there was some thought that Acosta was actually going to be in this team playing that Chara role, if you want to call it that, for this tournament. And I think Klinsmann got soured by his Acosta's performance with the U23 team in Olympic qualifying, and opted not. Although he did bring Perry Kitchen in, who was also on that team. I don't think Kitchen is dynamic enough to play that role. So that's a good point. Just for those who aren't aware of this, Darlington Nagbe actually plays centrally now for Portland in that three-man midfield that Chris is describing. He was playing out wide until well, Chris, about maybe July or August of last year, and manager Caleb Porter moved him centrally, had that three-man midfield, and it's dynamic. It works very, very well.
Sam, about the Costa Rica perspective, they're gonna have Kendall Watson missing because of the suspension, and I think that's gonna be a player that their defensive line will miss and the team will miss as well, because they rely pretty heavily on him as one of the leaders of that team.
Yeah, absolutely. They're gonna need to, as well as filling in for him, also going forward, as I said. This is similar to Paraguay, really need to be a lot more clinical up front. But yeah, I mean, Watson was fine in central defense against Paraguay. And I've honestly don't know enough about the Costa Rican squad to know who's going to be coming in to replace him. But judging from the opening day's performance, they're going to be big boots to fill.
Yeah. Absolutely. And there will obviously Joel Campbell will be one of the players that the US men's national team will be looking to nullify. So gentlemen, by the way, Karthik, I'm going to let you have a score prediction with this one because this is close to your heart.
Yeah, I think 1-1 is the most logical score prediction.
Oof.
I think that probably would have been the score in the qualifier in 2013 between these two teams had it not been played under in a blizzard, and the U.S. Got an important 3 points that day. I think they're very evenly matched up. I agree with Sam. Watson being out of the team is a very tough break for Costa Rica. Maybe again, it's players you're familiar with. I watch Watson week in and week out in MLS and think he's one of the better central defenders in the league and has done very well at the national team level, but there are real issues for the United States in marking Costa Rica's players going forward. We saw that in the qualifier in San Jose in 2013. We saw that again in a friendly last October, where any amount of space is given to Campbell, Joel Campbell, and Saborillo, Brian Ruiz. Brian Ruiz actually had a great game against the United States in 2009 on U.S. soil, where he scored twice very early, and that was the famous game, or infamous, in Costa Rica, where Jonathan Bornstein got the late goal, and Honduras qualified directly for the World Cup instead of Costa Rica. But two evenly matched teams. Costa Rica still talks about the 2013 game in that qualifier in the blizzard, and they feel like the U.S. owes them one. So they might nick a point here and put themselves in a position where if they can get something against Colombia the final match day, they can advance. For the U.S., that will make the Paraguay match a must-win.
All right. Tomorrow, we'll be back with Juan Arango, my good friend Gabe Smith, and the debut of Cesar Hernandez on the podcast to review these two games that we just discussed, as well as preview the Brazil-Haiti and the Ecuador-Peru game. So make sure you join us then. Until then, on behalf of everyone here at World Soccer Talk and the Eurocopa podcast, Kristen Henaj, Sam Kelly, and myself, Nipun Chopra, Karthik?
Enjoy your football.